President Obama has ordered a review of government agencies with a focus on those that deal with trade and exports. The president wants to double U.S. exports over the next 4 years and says the nation, in his words, can't win the future with a government built for the past. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The reorganization effort is being led by a Washington businessman in his first government job, Jeffrey Zients of the Office of Management and Budget. Zients says he's taking an approach that's common in the private sector.
And in fact, what we're doing is the same thing that the best businesses do all the time. We're stepping back and doing the analysis and determining how we, the U.S. government, can operate more efficiently and serve the public better.
By all accounts, the government doesn't operate very efficiently when it comes to promoting exports, which the Obama administration says is key to creating more jobs in the U.S. There are at least a dozen agencies that deal with trade and exports, ranging from the Commerce Department to the U.S. Trade Representative's Office to the U.S. Export-Import Bank. Jatinder Kohli has studied the issue for the Center for American Progress, a Washington think tank closely associated with the Obama administration. Kohli says the federal government is fragmented in the way it promotes trade and economic competitiveness.
You've got a very large number of agencies playing in the same kind of space. And if you ask yourself the very obvious question, who's the lead agency for promoting competitiveness or the future prosperity of the nation, the answer is we're not exactly sure.
Kohli says the solution might be a kind of super agency, a business, trade, and technology department.
And that department might bring together the work that the U.S. Trade Representative does with the Department of Commerce and also other trade-related work that's done around government and also potentially the work of the Small Business Administration.
Kohli says it's an approach tried with some success in Great Britain, which he knows firsthand, having worked on the project there. But reorganizing the U.S. bureaucracy is fraught with pitfalls. Paul Posner, the director of the Public Administration Program at George Mason University, likens it to moving boxes around. He points to the Department of Homeland Security, formed during the Bush administration after the 9/11 attacks. It consolidated some 22 different agencies into one bureaucracy, including a newly formed Transportation Security Administration.
We created the Department of Homeland Security by moving aviation security from the Department of Transportation into the Department of Homeland Security. So we solved one problem, but on the other hand, the FAA no longer had comprehensive control of airports anymore. So with every move, when we move a box, we solve one problem and create another one.
Another problem with restructuring the bureaucracy is Congress. Lawmakers have historically been unwilling to give up any of their turf. With the Department of Homeland Security, that has meant many, many overseers, says Robert Tobias of American University.
What do they have, 88 committees that DHS reports to? Now, how can any one department effectively report to 88 congressional committees, often when they're giving conflicting direction and advice?
Jeffrey Zients says he's aware of these pitfalls. The administration has been seeking input from lawmakers and from those he says are on the front lines, the government employees who will ultimately implement any changes. There's a website up seeking their suggestions.
I couldn't agree more that we want to make sure that we are not moving boxes for the sake of moving boxes. Reorganizations have some costs associated with them, and clearly whatever we recommend will have benefits that far outweigh the costs.
Zients' report to the president is due in June. Brian Naylor, NPR News, Washington.
The United Auto Workers are gearing up for contract negotiations with Chrysler, Ford, and General Motors. The automakers are in better shape than they were last time they signed labor contracts, so the union says it's a good time to negotiate. NPR's Sonari Glinton was at the UAW's annual convention and sent this report.
The UAW's meeting was held against the backdrop of recent fights between public sector workers, especially in Ohio and Wisconsin, and their governors. Here's UAW head Bob King speaking to union leaders.
They're putting the same agenda in all these state houses across the country. So it's incumbent on us as labor to come together and have a common strategy of how we're going to fight them.
Figuring out that strategy was part of what union leaders talked about. But the real subject was upcoming contract negotiations. The UAW's Bob King says recent good news for the car companies should mean good news for their workers.
Now, you always want the companies to be doing well when you're going to negotiations. You're in much better shape. You can do more for your membership when the companies are doing well.
I think that is sort of pie in the sky.
Sean McElinden with the Center for Automotive Research says the union is unlikely to win back major concessions, and their leaders know it.
The automotive market hasn't fully recovered by any means and is facing still a number of high-risk factors like higher gasoline prices or part shortages.
McElinden says how things go will largely depend on where gas prices and the economy are when negotiations begin in earnest this summer. Sonari Glinton, NPR News, Detroit.
We're broke. That's an expression we've been hearing a lot lately, including from legislators, mayors, and governors. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has been thinking about what that homey expression conveys.
The word economics comes from oikos, the Greek word for home, and originally referred to the art of household management. It hasn't meant that for some centuries, of course, but people are still drawn to describing the affairs of government in homey terms. Take "we're broke," which Republicans have made their mantra to justify cuts in government programs and services, none so insistently as John Boehner, who has been pleading the B-word for years, long before the B-word was cool. That claim that "we're broke" drives some people into a lather. A recent New York Times editorial called it obfuscating nonsense. No states are going to go bankrupt, it said, and a country with a big deficit is no more broke than a family with a college loan. E.J. Dionne called it a phony metaphor. And a recent Bloomberg article observed that you can't call a country broke when investors all over the world are lining up to lend it money for less than a 1% return. In response, though, a spokesman for Boehner said that a family is broke if they keep spending more than they're making. And who's to say that sort of definition is wrong? It isn't as if broke is a precise term like insolvent. And Republicans aren't the only ones who have found the word a handy label for government deficits. The New York Times editorial qualms haven't deterred the paper from running headlines like "California almost broke." And even Jon Stewart said not long ago that the country is broke, though he laid the blame on the extension of the Bush tax cuts. On the other hand, if the definition of broke is so loose, why go there in the first place? The Times called the word a scare tactic. And broke can raise specters of bailiffs and breadlines, and seems to come up a lot in the scenarios of imminent financial catastrophe in ads for vendors of gold coins and bullion. But broke can convey things other than fear. It comes from an old use of break to mean impoverish, and suggests an abiding association between destitution and destruction, the same connection that gives us wiped out and busted, not to mention the rupt of bankrupt, which came from the Italian for broken bank. The Victorians said all to smash, or more politely, ruined, which could suggest financial, moral, or social degradation, or sometimes all three together, as when a character in Thackeray's Vanity Fair says, "A countess living at an inn is a ruined woman." In fact, broke in its synonyms can convey those same overtones of shame and disgrace, which is why we say somebody who's gone broke is financially embarrassed. You can be born poor, but nobody's born broke. It's a calamity that happens to you through ill fortune or improvidence. But one way or the other, broke implies helplessness. As Ray Charles put it in "I'm Busted, There Ain't a Thing I Can Do." It brings to mind the little Monopoly man on the bankruptcy chance card, with his pockets turned out and his palms and shoulders raised in a plaintive shrug. That's what can make "we're broke" a self-absolving way of closing down a discussion, whether it comes from a parent or politician. What part of "we're broke" do you not understand? Well, okay, since I asked, it's the first part, actually. I get where "broke" is going, but I have some trouble with that "we." In my experience, people work more sleight of hand with that little pronoun than with any other word in the American political lexicon. Who exactly is the "we" on whom all that helplessness and humiliation have been visited? Well, who could it be but the American people, or the people of New Jersey, Wisconsin, or wherever? But if that's right, the statement's puzzling. It isn't as if the whole country is beggared or the American economy has collapsed. There's still a lot of money around in the aggregate, even if it's not spread around evenly, and there are places where the floorboards show through. That's where the pronoun gets tricky. "We" doesn't always mean you and I and the others. Thanks to the semantic operation called metonymy, the word can jump from one thing to something else that's connected with it. When I say "we're parked out back," I don't mean me and my wife, I mean our car. And when the president of the pep club shakes the tin where the cookie money's kept and says, "We're almost broke," she doesn't mean the members are all out of money, just the club's coffers. And that's pretty much what John Boehner and John Stewart mean when they say we're broke. Call it stealth metonymy. We're not broke, no more than we're parked out back. It's just the cookie fund. And that isn't the helpless, mortifying kind of broke that can descend on a family with nowhere to turn. We can either get some people to kick in a few more bucks, or we can spend the rest of the school year eating saltines. But whether it's the pep club or the federal government, that's a question of politics, not household management. And while you could describe the situation by saying, we're broke, that doesn't really move the conversation along very much. The problems with the pronoun, things would just be clearer if we were left out of it.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley. You can find links to all the clips and articles he referred to on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show.
My bills are all due, and the baby needs shoes, and I'm busted. Cotton is down to a quarter of a pound, but I'm busted. I got a cow that went dry and a hen that won't lay. A big stack of bills that gets bigger each day. The county's gonna haul my belongings away, 'cause I'm busted.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Rolling blackouts are expected to continue in the Tokyo area for months. That's largely because of the damaged nuclear power plants in Japan's Fukushima prefecture. The giant utility that serves the region, Tokyo Electric Power Company, or TEPCO, has lost 20% of its power capacity. As NPR's John Itzde reports, the blackouts are crippling businesses, from auto producers to fishmongers.
Even on a slow day, Tsukiji Market, the world's largest fish market, is a beehive of activity. Motorized carts buzz down narrow aisles carrying tuna carcasses. They're sawed into chunks and shipped to restaurants in Tokyo and around the world. Normally, these aisles would be jammed with buyers. Today, they're empty. Mr. Karu, a wholesaler, blames the blackouts.
I predict one-third of these wholesalers in this market will close the shop, the business. Main reason is the power source.
The rolling blackouts are reducing train service, making commuting unpredictable, so people don't stay downtown eating and drinking after work. The result is fish sales at Tsukiji are down about 50%. In the morning, the blackouts mean some rail commuters can't get to work on time. That's a problem for the big auto manufacturer Nissan.
Electricity going down creates its own damage.
Andy Palmer is a senior vice president at Nissan. He's trying to get the company's auto plants up and running, but he's plagued by power outages that shut down production and damage equipment.
Certainly the power outages are something that we're having to work with. Obviously, it's partially a negotiation with the local authorities.
But so far, TEPCO, one of the biggest privately owned power companies in the world, says it can't guarantee power to anyone. TEPCO says, when blackouts are required, we do not discriminate among our customers, whether industrial or residential. The problem is these rolling blackouts could continue for many months, even years.
This is a real problem for those factories which need uninterrupted supplies.
Professor Tatsuo Ohata, president of the National Graduate Institute for Policy Studies in Tokyo, says the situation might cause some companies to move.
It's clear that from their viewpoint, they'd better move their plant to the western part of Japan, where electricity is plenty.
But wouldn't it be much easier to send the surplus power from one side of Japan to the other to ease the blackouts? Well, that's harder than you might think, says Professor Hata.
One major problem is that the east and west of Japan have different electric cycles, and the capacity of the connectors are very much limited.
That's partly an accident of history. Eastern Japan followed the German model and has a 50-cycle electrical power grid. The West used the American model and has a 60-cycle grid. Transferring power from one grid to another requires a very expensive facility, and there are currently just 3 connections between Eastern and Western Japan. That bottleneck means the power transfer is just a trickle, even during this national emergency, and creating more capacity would take years. Hata says up until now, Japan's big utility companies, including TEPCO, liked the arrangement because it protected their monopoly pricing and made them very powerful politically.
The users of electricity, like Japan Steel, wouldn't say anything against electric utility companies. I mean, they are so much afraid. And also, many politicians wouldn't touch those electric utility companies.
Hata says the situation must change to reduce the stranglehold Japan's utilities have on the country's energy users.
One possibility is that on this occasion, Japanese government nationalize TEPCO.
The government could keep TEPCO's transmission lines and sell off its power plants to smaller producers who would compete to sell power to customers. For the time being, TEPCO says it's doing everything it can to secure more power. The stakes are incredibly high. Power consumption normally doubles during the heat of the summer. Right now, it seems unlikely TEPCO will be able to meet the demand, threatening more disruption for Japanese companies and workers and greater damage to Japan's fragile economy. John Idsti, NPR News, Tokyo.